media and so on, to inform policymakers and so on. That leads us really nicely on to Becky. Becky combines, there you go. Becky combines two hats together. The research hat, because Becky represents the research councils in medicine, but also the policy. How do you translate the policy into actual research? And maybe the other way around as well. So yet another dimension. Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a really nice segue into joining the dog. Sorry, I'm tweaking my power. As you just said, I'm coming from a slightly different angle on this again. Matt got in touch with me last week actually to come and ask me to talk about this. So it was quite an interesting thought experiment to step back and think about some of the things we're working on and how they might have an influence here. So Matt asked me the question, what do we need to do to drive innovation in healthcare in the UK? I thought I'd tackle this in a slightly more... I'm coming from the big picture, but also the practical side of this. So I'm going to give you a few examples of patient-centered innovation and policy-making in the health sector that I am seeing from my perspective, and then asking the question, how can innovation and policy-making work together to improve health outcomes in a practical way? I'm going to give you a case study of something we've been doing, which I think pulls out some of the ways you might approach a problem like that, and I hope all of that will give us some insights into what we need to do to drive innovation in healthcare in the UK. But first off, I'm going to tell you what AMRC is, because it's a bit of one of those strange acronyms that you just see at the end of reports and no one has any idea what they are. So we're a bit like what we say on the tin. Association of Medical Research Charities is a membership organisation of the leading medical and health research charities funding research in the UK. So that is charities like the Wellcome Trust, Cancer Research UK, British Heart Foundation, Alzheimer's Society, name a condition, there is a charity raising money to fund research into it. Our job is to work with our members to support the sector's effectiveness, to make every charity pound go as far as possible, to do research that then gets translated into treatments that really benefit patients. So we're interested in that whole pathway from the research in the lab right the way to getting it into the NHS and using the findings to improve the healthcare that people get when they go to their GP or their hospital. So the really interesting thing about medical research charities is they exist because the public choose to donate their money to support research. There's a real public support for research to happen, and I think that's quite important when you talk about patient-centered innovation, that there is this huge public support for research. And it translates into £1.2 billion a year going into medical research in the UK from the charitable sector. So that's about a third of public funding for for medical research. MRC is just around £1 billion, and so same NIHR. So it's quite a lot of money that's going in with this direct patient connection to it. And these charities actually are often hubs of expertise. If you think of a big charity like Age UK, they cover a huge range of issues. They're policy making for the elderly, they're dealing with pensions and all of that kind of thing. And they also fund about £1 million of research into health conditions and social research around healthcare for the elderly. So these are charities that are bringing together not just the research aspects, but the social care aspects and everything else. And they become real hubs of expertise where they bring everything together, and they can provide this mishmash of insights, which I think is so important for what we're talking about today. So a few examples of patient-centred innovation and policy-making in the health sector that I am seeing. Involving patients in developing research questions, asking patients what they actually want us to look at, what do we need the answer to. You might have come across the James Lind Alliance, which works with charities and pulls together groups of patients, clinicians, carers, everyone together. And they go through a process of identifying the priorities for research. So if you think about it, it's when you speak to someone with Parkinson's disease and they're like, yeah, this drug's great, but actually it makes me really tired and makes me constipated. Could you give me something for that? You know, do some research into making my quality of life better when you give me a drug. And it's trying to sort of think about the questions that actually matter to the people with the condition. So we're doing the right research in the first place and asking the right questions. And then there's also a really important part of getting patients' insights when designing the research itself. So this is a really nice example, actually, of where they were doing some, Parkinson's UK was funding some research with Parkinson's patients. And if you think Parkinson's patients tend to be older, they tend to have difficulty getting about, that can be a real barrier to them actually getting involved in the research. It can make recruitment to research really difficult. It means you can't get the trials off the ground and they don't happen. So what did they do? They talked to the patients about what they needed. They designed a system so that they were actually paying for bus travel, people to come and pick them up, taxi drivers. I mean, one of the really interesting things here is that the taxi driver who's reliable and patient, someone who will be happy to sit there while you have a patient who maybe has mobility issues, get to the taxi. And that's the stuff that's really crucial to make the research happen. And this is another really interesting example. Arthritis Research UK, many of our charities have patients, lay reviewers on their peer review panels, and they involve patients. And this is a user committee involving the healthcare professionals and patients in panels to talk about the research as it's designed. And here they were able to say, you know, someone might not have just one artificial joint. So think about that when you're designing the research project so that you actually get reliable results. And it is something that if you step back and talk to the patient, they can probably tell you stuff, really obvious stuff that you just won't think about when you're a researcher. So it can actually make us do better research as well. And then this is a really interesting area and one that I think we're still learning a lot about, taking patients' perceptions of risk into account. If you think about if you've got terminal cancer and there's a really risky treatment that doctors, you know, don't know that much about, but it's there and it's a possible treatment, it might possibly help. Your perception of how risky it is to take that drug might be very different to someone who's very healthy and it's for a condition that's just causing them a bit of gripe, they've got a sort of ache or something that they want dealing with. That patient may have a very, very different perception of risk. And how far do we allow that their different perception of risks to influence whether we let them take part, trial a new drug or something like that? Because there is a certain element of you've got to protect people from taking huge risks that they might then come to regret. You know, it might backfire, it might shorten their life, you know, anything could happen, or it might leave them living with something that is very sort of debilitating, having a lesser quality of life once they've had the treatment. But at the same time, if they want to take part and it's their choice and they want to take that risk, should we stop them? It's a really interesting question. And this was some research at Glamorgan, I think, took this forward, which made a number of regulations recommendations after talking about that. They're really being thought about now, and I think you might have heard about conversations around more adaptive approaches to licensing, so changing our regulatory system a little bit so we actually take into account some of these patient perceptions of the risks involved and think about that when we're developing trials, which actually, if we can find a good way to do it, could mean that patients could maybe access drugs sooner when they haven't gone through the traditional phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, which can take a really long time. Whether there are ways where we can be more flexible and allow certain groups of patients to access new treatments at a phase 2 level and then collect data as they're taking them in that part of the trial. So just redesigning how we actually do research and to bring new treatments to patients. And CASME, which has been set up in Oxford and links with UCL and also works with the Wellcome Trust and various others, is starting to sort of galvanise some of these conversations. And there's a lot of conversation going on at a European level about these approaches. And actually, I hate to say it, but the US is quite a long way ahead of us in looking at some of these different, more adaptive approaches. But we're using that to encourage the UK policymakers to hurry up. but you're also seeing a real patient engagement with this conversation. And actually, this is the really interesting thing, how patients can maybe drive the conversation forward. The Empower campaign was set up by a chap called Les Halpin, who had motor neuron disease. He actually, unfortunately, died a few months back. But when he got the condition, he thought he was in a position to give a voice. He had the money to pay for a PR firm to set up this campaign. And he's worked really hard to try and galvanise the conversation and get people talking about how patients might access drugs sooner and how they might be involved in that process, their perceptions of risk. And this can be a real way to help sort of shape how things move forward. There's another, you might have come across Lord Saatchi's Medical Innovation Bill, which is currently in the House of Lords and the House of Commons. It's a private member's bill that he's brought. Lord Saatchi's wife died fairly recently of a form of ovarian cancer, and he was seriously frustrated with the system and the fact that he was concerned that doctors weren't trying out innovative new medicines because they were scared of getting sued, basically. So this bill tries to create a system where doctors could prescribe an innovative new medicine without risk of being sued. It's one step in a very, very big jigsaw how you might change it, because I think a lot of the conversations you might have about this bill is that might be one of the barriers, but actually a lot of doctors don't even know there's an innovative new treatment they could try. We need to try and join the whole circle up. And I think I don't know if any of you have come across CLARCS. It's taken me a really long time to learn the acronym, so I've actually had to write it down because there's no way I could actually remember it. It took me long enough to work out how to spell it. These are set up relatively recently, I think in about 2008, 9 of them were set up. And they've actually been really successful, and they've had their funding extended, and there's now going to be 13, so they're roughly equivalent with each of the new academic health science networks, the 15 of those we've got around the UK. And they're set up to try and build links between universities and hospitals, and also bring in sort of external funders like industry and charities, and try and build those links and actually do research at a local level. So they're very linked to their geographical location. And there was a really interesting paper came out. I think one of the journals is doing a whole series of papers looking at some of the CLARCS. But this one just caught my eye this week, which looks at two of the CLARCS and how successful they've been. And one, Penn CLARC, which is in the southwest, actually focused on engaging patients in the public. And I really like this quote where one patient described all these possibilities as an Aladdin's cave of opportunity. But the really interesting thing here, and I'll build on this in a second, is the three commitments that underpin this work are money, time, and actually spending time to work out and develop that relationship. So investing in it was the only way to get something back out of it. And I think one of our big challenges is trying to reach a point where we actually have the time and the money and the investment in it to actually be able to do this well. So these are pockets of good practice that are actually delivering, but I think the real challenge is how do we make them common practice and join them up right the way across the UK. I'm going to give you a case study of something we did to try and see if we could try and start joining up the dots. The Health and Social Care Act passed in 2012, and after a lot of campaigning by a lot of charities and supporters of medical research, there is now a duty across the Secretary of State, Jeremy Hunt, the NHS Commissioning Board, which is NHS England, and every single clinical commissioning group to promote the use of research and research evidence. They have to do it. But the big question is, what's that actually look like? Because that doesn't really mean much. This is wily policy words, and I mean, we got it beefed up from have regard to the need to promote. I'm not quite sure what the difference is, but it sounds a bit stronger, so it's got to be a good thing. Realising that we don't really know what that looks like, and this is a real opportunity that we could take to really ensure that research gets built in right throughout this new system as it sets up, we set out to develop our vision for research in the NHS. And we did this by pulling together lots of patient groups, charities, academics, clinicians, everyone else, to start talking about what some of the challenges are to getting involved in research. And we also did a survey of 390-odd health professionals. So this was GPs, nurses, and hospital doctors working in the UK. Working in England, obviously, because it's just England. We found near universal agreement that the NHS should support research into treatments for patients. That's not really surprising. You'd hope they'd say that. But really interestingly, only 22% of GPs felt it was very important for them to be involved in research themselves. I mean, I think this shows a challenge of what being involved in research means, whether they understand what that means, and also just a sort of I think the other finding we found really kind of brings this home. 91% of all those surveys identified barriers they'd experienced to taking part in research, including lack of time. 62% of those people asked, that's the hospital doctors, nurses and GPs, said they had not enough time to get engaged with research. And I think this is really kind of bringing home some of the challenges we need to address before we even get down to how we do it. It's making the space for people to think about it. But I mean, we did see, as you'd expect from the amount of money going into collection boxes to fund research, 72% of people tell us they want to be offered opportunities to be involved in clinical trials of new treatments. But really interestingly, that didn't translate into asking your GP or your doctor if there was an opportunity to get involved in research. Just about half of healthcare professionals told us they're asked by their patients about research opportunities less than once a year. So we haven't even got that patient pull going on here. We're not actually asking healthcare professionals about opportunities to get involved in research, and that's maybe one of the other dots we need to join. So after all these conversations, we developed some visionary statements. Our vision for research in the NHS is that every patient is offered opportunities to be involved in research. All NHS staff see the importance of research, and the NHS conducts high quality research and adopts new treatments. Now, they sound great. It would be wonderful if we could achieve these, but we're very conscious that it's actually practical steps. It's building the environment where these things can actually flourish and happen that we need to take next. So this is just a sample of some of the practical recommendations and calls we made in that report. They're really simple things. Provide information about taking part in research and opportunities to self-refer so that patients can actually find out and ask their healthcare providers questions about research and start creating that pull. Simple things like include research knowledge and evidence in basic training for all NHS staff, so they can actually all understand what research is, understand when their colleagues are doing it and maybe support them doing it, or get involved in it themselves. Require clinicians to consider every patient's suitability to take part in research as part of their care. They're little things, and they sound like horrible, like tick box exercises, but if you start getting that sort of lever, you might start creating the space for all the other stuff to happen. Develop a quality mark to signify where patients have been involved in the design of the study. Again, another lever to try and encourage people to actually involve patients in the design. And then you get the more sort of process things. Ring-fence time for research in NHS contracts. I think that might be a key one. And clarify who pays for research costs. So much research doesn't happen because there's so much tangle of who's going to pay and who actually benefits. A lot of the people, the CCG gets asked to pay for some research, they probably won't see the benefits coming back from that, or they won't notice the benefits because it won't be coming back marked as this is a benefit of doing research. You've saved money here, but maybe we need to do more to create that feedback loop. And this, I think, is one of the key ones. Encourage NHS commissioners to implement our research charter to ensure their actions are informed by evidence. And we actually went through and put down a list of things that CCGs should do to think about research, because it's the commissioners that need to start thinking about it. It's the things like talking to their local universities and their clinicians and talking about the questions they want answering, which will then maybe inform the commissioning decisions they make later. And actually, there was a really nice example from that Clarks paper where when the Clarks first set up, they all struggled to get the commissioners to talk to them. They were all just like, oh, go away, too much to do, don't want to talk to you. And they spent a lot of time working with them and actually developed a system where they were doing little reviews of some of the drugs and condition drugs that the commissioners might be thinking of paying for, and they could provide them extra analyses which then help them make decisions and help them save a bit of money. And then by the end of the paper, and it's worth a read because there's just lots and lots of quotes of, we think they're brilliant, NHS commissioners singing the praises of the clerk. So it was a real case of winning them round. But one of the strong learnings from that as well was it was the personal relationships. It was taking the time to have those conversations and actually shape things in the way that people needed in responding to their concerns. So like I can say, there's lots of grand things about how this vision was welcomed by NHR and NHS England. So we've got them at the top. It's now at the feeding down and starting to speak to the BMA GPs committee and talking to the GPs about what they need to get involved in research, joining the dots, maybe meeting with some of the academic health science networks and the clinical commissioning groups. And there is maybe even the possibility of getting the charities involved in campaigning and pushing the message and sort of pulling all the levers to kind of create that environment where you just wouldn't not do patient-centred innovation. So hopefully I've given you some insights into what I think's helpful. I was sitting there jotting down some other thoughts. I think what's key and what came through from all the things in the practical manifestations of this that I see is you need to make it easy for everyone to get involved. The GPs, patients, they need to have the time, the encouragement, the support, the information that they can understand. And you need to help everyone see the value, and that's transparency and research results. It's interpreting them, giving them to people in a way that they can use them. It's no good doing the research if we don't then translate it and give it back to the clinicians in a way that they can understand and put it into practice. It's creating the feedback loops. And I think once we've got the feedback loops, they'll make themselves, and it will. Everyone will then make the time for research. But that's the vision. I'm not sure how long it will take us to get there. Thanks very much.
There was so much in there. There's two points I'd like to make. One point is that you've clearly exposed a no man's land, GP land, the primary care. There's still, and I've intuitively, I'm sure you agree, intuitively feel there's a huge potential because that's the gateway. That's how people get into the NHS. So prevention, early detection and so on, we need to work in primary care. That's the first thing. The second thing is you've got highlighted is the word risk. To me, innovation and risk are two sides of the same coin. You cannot do innovation without risk. And it's great to hear that we are thinking more about accepting risk. If you look at industry, the best organizations are, Apple, Virgin, and so on, are risk-tolerant organizations. They thrive on risk. They identify risk, manage it, and are able to tolerate it. And I think that's where we need to get to as well. With people with serious conditions, to have a debate about risk is actually hugely important. And it's good that you highlight another set area, which is the regulator. The regulators are starting to be open and understand that they have to give, they have to really manage innovation and risk in a different way.
I think it's now getting over here. Pharmaceutical companies are scared of risk.
It will go wrong, but people are being killed in hospitals today anyway. So I don't want to be flippant. It's not a good place to be anyway. So there is risk today. And we have to be honest about it and say, can we accept more risk? And what can we gain from that? And